This is the Afternoon Magazine. Good afternoon. I'm Celeste Quinn. Thanks so much for tuning in. On the program today, we're going to get a glimpse of the Teamsters at the time Jimmy Hoffa was in the ascendancy. The story we'll focus on is one of a driver, Jim Harper, who led a fight to clean up Minneapolis Local 544 and, in doing so, crossed paths with Hoffa. Jim Harper was convinced that Hoffa would side with him in the fight to end corruption at the local. Instead, Harper found himself targeted for murder. Our guest is Jim Harper's son, Stephen Harper. He is the author of Crossing Hoffa, a Teamster's Story. As a kid, Stephen Harper knew there were things not to be spoken of. He wasn't to be too inquisitive. Floodlights bathed the family's home at night. There was a shooting range and a studio for recording telephone calls in the basement. But it wasn't until Stephen Harper began sorting through his father's papers following his death that he began to delve into and appreciate this chapter of his father's life. This afternoon, we'll hear how it was Stephen Harper began to investigate this story and what he learned. Listeners, I invite your questions and comments for our guest, Stephen Harper. You can join us with a telephone call. The number in the Champaign-Urbana area is 333-9455. That's 333-WILL. We also have a toll-free number. That number is 800-222-9455, 800-222-WILL. Let me tell you just a bit more about our guest. Stephen Harper has been a litigation attorney at Kirkland & Ellis, LLP, for more than 20 years, a graduate of Harvard Law School and Northwestern University. He is an adjunct professor of trial advocacy at Northwestern University's School of Law. Crossing Hoffa, A Teamster's Story, was published last year. It is now also available as an audiobook from Spoken Books Publishing. You'll find Stephen Harper online at www.crossinghoffa.com. Again, the phone number is 333-9455 and toll-free 800-222-9455. Stephen Harper, it's good to talk with you. How are you?
Well, I'm fine. Thank you very much for your interest, and thanks for inviting me on the show.
Yeah, it's a great story.
Well, thank you.
Go ahead.
But I was going to say, you know, as an author, you never know for sure what happens after a book goes out there unless somebody like you actually responds. Although I have to tell you, you're not alone in your reaction. I've received literally hundreds of letters, and I don't know about you, but I've read lots of books, but I've never written a letter to an author of a book I like. But I've received hundreds of letters from people who've been touched in a number of different ways by the book. It's been quite a moving experience for me. So,
yeah. Well, let's talk about how it all started. Following
sure.
your father's death, you opened a strong box where he had kept his most important papers. What did you find?
Well, he had kept, along with his birth certificate, my mother's birth certificate, his marriage certificate, and birth certificates for their four children. I'm the oldest of four. And in there also he had kept, to my astonishment, remnants from his days as a rank-and-file Teamsters over-the-road truck driver. My father, in his later years, actually was an executive in the trucking industry. And I knew, of course, that he'd been a driver because once in a while, when I was a very small child, he had smuggled me in the cab along with him on some of his trips, which probably wasn't the brightest thing to do, but nevertheless it made for an exciting childhood for me. In any event, what I discovered when I opened the box were his union cards from the late 50s and early 60s, and a union dues booklet. And then I went to another package of materials that he had also kept, which were materials that documented in a very precise way. My father had never gone to college, but he was really always a frustrated journalist, and he was a very bright man, as is my mother, is a bright woman. And he had kept very detailed notes, contemporaneously prepared, single-space, typewritten notes of a remarkable chapter in his life, and it was a time when he had, albeit inadvertently, crossed swords with Jimmy Hoffa, the most powerful and charismatic labor leader of his time. And so what I did, he also had kept letters that he had sent to Hoffa, along with Hoffa's very terse replies relating to an insurgency that he had started in late 1959. And we'd always, in our family, we'd always refer to that period in our lives and my dad's journey as the quote-unquote union fight. And I realized after he died, this was in 2001, that I found this stuff shortly after he died. And I realized then that I never really understood the full dimensions of that struggle in ways that I should, because at the time it was happening, I was, you know, 6 or 7 years old. And although he talked with me about it a lot, I never really felt like I had a great understanding of the story or what was happening on both sides of that equation. And so what then resulted for me really was an effort to answer two questions, because what happened was my dad launched a rebellion within his local, as you've quite properly described. And what he had targeted there was a local leader who he said was and claimed and had proven, he thought, was skimming dues from union members, and it outraged him. And so he launched an insurgency. It was a very sophisticated one dealing with elections and so forth. But the long and the short of it is, what my father never knew, even up to the moment of his death, was that Hoffa had put that local guy in charge. And so, in any event, one thing led to the next. And so I was really on my way to answer two questions, because the insurgency that my father began created so much trouble for Hoffa that he came to town, met privately with my father in a downtown Minneapolis hotel for 3 hours, told my father to stop the crusade, and as you correctly state, my dad found himself on the receiving end of death threats and murder attempts for the next 2 years as he pressed on. So for me, the exercise was really twofold. One, why would my father press ahead when the most powerful and charismatic labor leader of his time, maybe of any time, Jimmy Hoffa, tells you person to person, face to face, in a 3-hour conversation to stop, and you don't. And then on Hoffa's side, it was curious to me because, as you again correctly pointed out, this all unfolded in Minneapolis, and I couldn't figure out for the life of me why a man of Hoffa's stature, and we sometimes forget now because of the sort of the "Where's Jimmy" jokes that have become a large part of the Hoffa legacy, but we forget he was such a giant in the labor movement in the 50s. And in the early 60s, why would he care about a relatively inconsequential insurgency in an insignificant town, Minneapolis, launched by a wholly unimportant character like my father? You know, this is Mr. Ordinary Guy, and all of a sudden he's sitting in a room with, why does Hoffa care? So it was the effort to answer those two questions that propelled me into the project of researching more fully than my father ever had, and I found things that were frankly stunning and would have absolutely amazed my father as I got deeper into it.
Yeah, he was unaware of so many things that were swirling about at the time.
Well, I think that's kind of, there are a number of things, and this is what I've learned from some of the correspondence I've received from people who've read the book. There's a universality to the phenomena that my father went through, in the sense that sometimes, and all of us at times, are in periods of struggle or turmoil, and it's very hard to get what I would call sufficient objective distance so that you can see clearly what's going on around you, and clearly this was one of those times for him. But there is a lesson to be learned about the importance of sometimes having someone you trust say to you, hey, you know, maybe you're off a little wild on this one, because look at this. But it's a... It became, as you note, a swirl that really eluded him. Although because of his own background and his own experiences, it wasn't an intentional thing. It was just, you know, we all have a tendency, I think, to see what we want to see and hear what we want to see. You can apply that to what's going on in the election now. You know, it's sort of amazing the way people look at the same candidate saying the same thing, and they'll come away with completely different reactions to whether that was a good or a bad performance, because they really went into it with a sort of preconceived notion of what they wanted to see.
You described your dad a moment ago as an ordinary guy, and in a way, he was, but he was also extraordinary. Why press ahead? It was just the kind of guy he was, and part of that had to do with a very important experience in his life when he spent a year in Louisiana's infamous Angola prison. Tell us what Angola was like at the time and what he had done, and how did he get through that time?
You know, it's interesting. It's one of the early chapters of the book, and it was actually the last chapter I wrote. It was a very hard chapter for me to write, in part because my father had been very honest with us kids growing up. He said, look, I made lots of mistakes when I was a kid, So be creative. Here are my mistakes. Here are the things I did wrong. As you go forward in life, be creative. You know, come up with new things. Don't make the same mistakes I did. So he had told me that he had gotten into trouble. He had married his high school sweetheart. The marriage went bad, and he went into a depression, and, you know, fueled by alcoholism, he wound up passing bad checks throughout the country in order to sort of keep moving forward. It's probably not the right direction, but just to keep moving. And he wound up, as you say, in Louisiana. Well, I had never known until in the course of researching for this book that the place where he had been in prison was Angola, which, and I found an article in my research that Collier's Magazine had written while he was there that described, the title of the article says it all. It says, America's Worst Prison. This is a place where, you know, we think about brutal conditions now, and there are photographs in the book, as you know, of the conditions at the time, which is sort of another remarkable find for me. I couldn't believe that I actually had photos of conditions and the place while he was there, but in the early 50s. But just to give you a sense of it, there was no difference. They didn't make any classification or segregation, if you will, of prisoners based upon the type of offense. There was racial segregation, so that there were black quarters and there were white quarters. But for example, my father wound up in a barracks with double and triple bunk beds of 300 to 400 men, and the guy in his lower bunk. My dad had passed a few bad checks, you know, totaling probably $150 altogether. And the guy in his lower bunk was a convicted murderer, and there was no separation of prisoners. A cell would have been a wonderful thing for him to have experienced, if you can imagine that, because here your greatest enemy was, you know, the guy in the bunk below you, or I should say the source of your greatest fear was any one of the other 300 people for whom there was no restriction of their movement within a barracks. And so it was just... It was just a sort of a stunning revelation for me to encounter this stuff and really understand more than I ever had the depths to which he had descended when he was placed in that place. And it's no surprise that, you know, most people that go into that place, either psychologically or physically, they don't survive it. At least they didn't survive it. So in that sense, even just coming out, you know, as a half of what you were going in is a remarkable feat, but it set him up for what ultimately happened with Hoffa, because a partial answer to the question of why does he proceed after Jimmy Hoffa himself personally tells him to stop lies in the fact that, you know, here he is 7 years after Angola with an opportunity, he thinks, to redeem his life. You know, here he is, he was worthless, and, you know, prison and all the baggage that goes with being a convicted felon, and there was a lot more baggage in the early 50s in terms of even after you were out, there was a lot more stigma associated with a criminal conviction than there is now, and there's still plenty now. But he couldn't stop. You know, he had to go forward. He couldn't suffer another defeat. He had to. This was the moment that was going to redeem his life, and so then it all starts to make sense. Okay, now I get it. You know, now I understand why, you know, they send death threats into the house and threatening phone calls, and they sabotage your truck as you're, you know, trying to make your trip down the Great Mississippi River Road, which is a harrowing under the best of circumstances. But Angola, the experience of Angola set him up. And he was 21, 22 years old when that happened. And I have kids that are that age now. So, I mean, it was sort of a double whammy on me, because I try to imagine my own children in the circumstance in which he found himself when he was in his early 20s. And it's just mind-boggling.
Yeah. What led your father to become a trucker and a member of the Teamsters?
Well, it was a number of different things. Initially, he was just casting about trying to find a job. So that he started out as a part-time clerk working for a trucking company, and the union was everything in those days. We lose sight of it now because unions are under they're under siege, and it may come as a surprise to some of your listeners, and it certainly comes as some surprise to the readers of the book that I don't really have any agenda one way or the other as it relates to the union with respect to this book. I actually have some sympathy for the modern plight of the current labor movement. But my dad's situation in those days, you know, unions were pretty powerful places. So he got a job, and there was a guy working with him in the office who was an organizer for the union. And that guy, one way or another, was able to pull strings and got him initially a job working on the loading dock. And joining the union for my father was in, I think, a sense of community for him. It's very hard to go through life alone, and he had enough of a difficulty in his early years with his parents, and I think that the Teamsters provided a very real community for him, and one that he was very proud of, and he ultimately launched his rebellion against the local business. It was a secretary treasurer was the most powerful position in the local at that time. And, you know, he launched his attack on this guy because he thought, this guy's taken union dues from people. This should be the health and welfare people. And so it was an effort to sort of clean up his own, help Hoffa, really, he thought he was doing, clean up his own shop when he went forward. Because we forget, too, that back in the 50s and into the early 60s, Hoffa was very much the reformer in terms of a Teamsters leader. He got a lot of heat from Bobby Kennedy and others as he moved forward, but initially he rose to power in 1957 because he was going to be the guy that cleaned the union up, and his predecessor was on his way to jail, and so he was very much a reform candidate. And when my father launched all of his activities aimed at a local corrupt local guy, he actually thought he was doing Hoffa a favor, It just shows sometimes, you know, things are not always as they seem, but that took him into that place.
Mm. Our guest this afternoon in this portion of the program is Stephen Harper. He is a son of Jim Harper, who was a Teamster, and he was a driver who led a fight to clean up Minneapolis Local 544, and in doing so crossed paths with Jimmy Hoffa. Stephen Harper is the author of Crossing Hoffa, A Teamster's Story. My name is Celeste Quinn. This is the Afternoon Magazine. Listeners, you can join us this afternoon with questions, comments, 333-9455, the number in the Champaign-Urbana area, anywhere else toll-free, 800-222-9455. Let's take some calls now. Let's go first to a listener in Urbana on line one. Hi.
Hello.
Hello.
I was wondering if you knew of how many Teamsters had criminal records at that time, and if, unbeknownst to your father, he may have been recruited because he had a criminal record.
It's an interesting question and a good one. Actually, part of what happened in the late 50s, as a result of the investigations that Bobby Kennedy was the senior Senate counsel on, and there were very famous confrontations between Hoffa and the Kennedys on this stuff. They actually passed legislation that required Hoffa to rid the union of felons, and Hoffa did that to some degree, but refused to another degree. The short answer, I think, to the question is, at least in my father's case, the fact of his having been a felon was something that was not generally known beyond his immediate family. So in terms of whether that was a reason for him to be recruited to the union, the answer would be no. He wound up in the union because he was... It was a job that he could get, and he just kind of worked his way up through to the point where, and in those days, the ultimate job was to be an over-the-road trucker. Those were the guys that made the most money, and he eventually moved, as I say, from the loading dock up to behind the wheel. So anyway, that's the answer to the listener's question, I think. That would not have been the reason that they recruited him.
Let's take another call. A listener in Savoy on line four. Hi.
Hi, Celeste. Great show. Thanks for taking my call. Your guest kind of touched on it a little bit, but I was just wondering if he could maybe expound on the relationship between Hoffa and the Kennedys. I think with your father at the time, I think this was probably going on the similar time. And I think back to a movie about Hoffa, and actually when JFK was killed, I guess it was great rejoicing by Jimmy Hoffa. And I didn't know if you had any personal recollections on that, but it seems to me that the mafia, if I'm correct, they were pretty strongly influenced the Teamsters and the corruption. And not only that, but I was wondering if you had any personal stories or feelings about actually what did happen to Hoffa. And I'll go ahead and ring off. Thanks.
Okay.
Sure. Let me try to take them in order. The interesting thing about Hoffa and organized crime, and this is part of what evolved, what happened, or what resulted in terms of the book, were really two stories. It's the story of Jimmy Hoffa from the beginning, and the story of my father from the beginning, and the paths that they took up to the moment of their collision, and then ultimately the book then plays out from that point forward. But in order to understand all that, I thought I needed to understand where Hoffa was coming from too. And the interesting thing to me about Hoffa was that, in terms of organized criminal stuff, that really became organized crime, and I would say criminal elements really entered into Hoffa's life as a matter of self-defense in the 40s, when he was in just trying to save his own union, because another rival union, the AFL, the CIO, under Denny Lewis, whose brother John was also a big deal labor leader, was trying to raid his local in Detroit. So he went outside to help, and the help that he got were people that, you know, once you let them inside, it's hard to get them out again. And that's really how it started. And ultimately, the Kennedy connection came in a big way after Hoffa became president of the Teamsters in 1957, because the McClellan Committee hearings, which really were responsible in many ways for launching both Bobby Kennedy and John Kennedy in terms of national political careers, really focused on Hoffa. And one of the things that emerged from all that was, unlike his predecessor, Hoffa had refused to take the Fifth Amendment and was really kind of he was tough and gruff, and he went at him and all that kind of stuff. And there was in a very, very much a blood feud, I think is the best way to put it, between the Kennedys and the Hoffas. I mean, they really did hate each other. And I guess the third and final question, which has to do with, what about where's Jimmy now? Which it's sort of interesting to me, and that's not surprising at all. And I'm actually grateful for it, because if people didn't have that question, I doubt that anyone would be interested in the book or anything, because I just don't think we'd talk about Hoffa if it weren't the mysterious circumstances of his disappearance that kept his legacy alive in some ways. But I do think, and actually there's a chapter at the end of the book where I discuss my view of what I think sort of hangs together as the most cogent story of what happened to Hoffa. And without giving away too much of it, I would say this, that those who lived by the sword died by the sword. And I think that it just in some ways, as there were organized criminal activities that ultimately launched Hoffa's career, or certainly were responsible for keeping him and getting him into a very high office in the Teamsters, my own personal feeling, and it's only that, if I knew for sure, I wouldn't be alive to have this conversation with anybody, I'm sure. My own personal feeling is that the weight of the evidence suggests pretty strongly that it was organized criminal elements that were responsible for his demise. I don't believe the stories, under Giant Stadium or that sort of stuff. I do think that he was probably his end probably came fairly close to where he disappeared, which was from a parking lot outside a Detroit restaurant, waiting. He thought for a man who had been in prison with him, also convicted of organized criminal activity in New Jersey, to meet up with him. And who he met up with, who knows, but that was the last time he was seen.
Yeah. Let's get to your second question. As you began this investigation, why Minneapolis? What was Hoffa's connection to Minneapolis?
That became a very fascinating question for me. It turned out, and I didn't know this at all, that Hoffa had actually gotten his initial launch and national profile when the then president of the Teamsters in the 1930s, the international president, sent Hoffa to gain control over the union there in the face of what had been very high-profile and deadly Minneapolis Teamsters strikes. There were labor strikes all over the country in the early 30s, and Minneapolis in particular was the site of a very deadly one, and as a result there was tremendous interest, and frankly the president of the Teamsters sent Hoffa, who at that time was in his early 20s, from Detroit to Minneapolis to sort of get control of the situation, which Hoffa did. From then, as you move forward in time, by the time you get to the time that my father was involved in his activities in the late 50s, it turned out that many of the people and events that would eventually be responsible for sending Hoffa to jail in 1967 were actually unfolding and developing in Minneapolis at precisely the same time that my father was bringing more sunlight to shine on the city. So the last thing Hoffa needed was more attention brought to that city, and my father was bringing it. Although there was an ironic twist there too, because as you know, the newspaper reporter who my father thought was a fellow confidant, his sort of quiet informer, you know, keeping things in the public eye because he could write about him in the Minneapolis Tribune. At that time, that's what it was called, and it turned out he was, in fact, a Hoffa, if not an apologist, if not a mole, he certainly was an apologist, but I think probably a mole is a better term for it. So the story took all kinds of weird twists and turns for me as I learned more about it.
I think he was more than a mole. I think he was a rat.
Yeah, well, you're probably right. That's been the most common reaction that people have had. I think, you know, but there's an interesting lesson to be learned there, too, in a contemporary sense. You know, there's a guy, he was a newspaper reporter. He was a sort of a second-rate labor reporter for the Minneapolis Tribune. They had a first-rate reporter who worked out of the Washington Bureau, who actually put all kinds of heat on Hoffa, a guy named Clark Mollenhoff, who was a tremendous. He won the Pulitzer Prize for his investigation into the Teamsters in the late 50s. But the other guy, the number two guy, who was the mole and, as you describe, a rat, I think ultimately he fell victim to what I think a lot of news people, media people, fall victim to. And you see it now. I mean, you see the same phenomenon now. And that is, if you're dependent upon your sources for insight and news and information and you're going to write about them, well, then you're going to, you know, there's a reluctance, I think, that some reporters have to take a real hard look at those people. And I think Hoffa was very good at that in terms of exploiting people that way. And I think you see that all the time. I think there have been lots of proper criticism leveled at the press, not just in this election, but over the last, you know, 10 or even 15 years. You can say, well, where's the critical media in all this? Aren't they supposed to be, you know, challenging these guys? Don't ask easy questions, ask tough ones, you know, but everybody's so concerned about, well, we don't want to offend this and we don't want to offend that, and at the end of the day, the reporter doesn't want to offend a key source, and that was the dilemma that this reporter in Minneapolis found himself in, because he was trying to write a book about the Teamsters, and in order to write his book about the Teamsters, he needed access that he was not going to get unless he covered the Teamsters in a very particular apologetic and even a friendly way. So,
At the same time, though, as you pointed out, there was this other reporter who was a fine journalist, and today there are fine journalists,
absolutely,
and they're doing
right.
their jobs. And you know, occasionally you're going to get kicked off the bus or off the plane. So be it.
My hat's off to those people, because I'll tell you, as society becomes even more, you know, we're all sort of attention deficit people. The attention span is of people generally gets shorter and shorter, you know, if you can't push it into a sound bite, no one's going to pay any attention to it. And my hat's off to people who are willing to take a stand, you know, in a funny way, as you say, as Clark Mollenhoff did, as my father did, and as journalists, some journalists today do. You know, take the heat, because ultimately that's what a democratic society requires. I wish more and more would do it, but you know, you get these. We always, is this a left-leaning network or a right-leaning network? And you know, you get all this. Everything's all polarized, and it doesn't do anybody any good.
Yeah. Well, let's go back now to 1959.
Yes.
And things are. Hoffa has a lot of problems, and the fight your dad's got with him, or not with him at that time, is your dad doesn't really know it's Hoff is the part of the problem, but your dad, you know, wants to fight for a clean local, but Jimmy Hoff has got that problem. He's got some sunlight coming in on the Minneapolis local, and he's got other problems, and so he goes to work courting Richard Nixon.
Isn't that something? Yes. And again, this was there at every turn, every week or two, I'd have one of these sort of holy smokes moments, you know, as I was putting a lot of these puzzle pieces together. But yes, you know, Hoffa, some of this goes back to his disdain for the Kennedys. The last thing he wanted to see was John Kennedy in the White House, and so as a result, in the Democratic primaries, although he didn't come right out and do it, he actually supported Humphrey. When it was clear that Humphrey wasn't going to do it, he decided, well, okay, then let's go to the convention and see. Maybe Stevenson or Johnson or somebody like that can emerge. When that didn't work, he went back to Richard Nixon. And the relationship between Richard Nixon, who was nominated shortly after as the Republican candidate in 1960, shortly after the Democrats nominated Kennedy. The symbiotic relationship between Richard Nixon and Jimmy Hoffa was a fascinating one because, you know, ultimately what Hoffa was looking for initially when he first opened up a line of communication to Nixon through an intermediary, a California congressman, a retired California congressman, was he was looking for somebody to take the heat off federal investigations that were happening under the Eisenhower administration. So he wanted that attorney general to do something for him, and Nixon involved himself enough to be, I guess, to be able to give assurances to somebody that, well, the case would be given a very hard look and maybe we could get, you know, the feds to back off of the ongoing investigation of Jimmy. And the investigation related to his use of, or misuse of pension funds relating to a real estate development. But then once Nixon lost the election, he was sort of out of luck. Well, you fast forward, and lo and behold, you get into the early 70s, and who's the guy who pardons Jimmy Hoffa and lets him out of jail? It's Richard Nixon.
Hmm.
Just a fascinating kind of continuity there. And what I didn't know, and of course nobody knew, or very few people knew, that was that behind the scenes, Hoffa was, I mean, he was working, if you can imagine somebody that would be working the very top echelons of both national political conventions at the same time, just looking for some influence to try to get some heat off him personally, but actually getting it done. I mean, this—it's mind-boggling, but it gives you some sense of both the qualities of personality and charisma, which is at some level you have to respect that he could achieve this kind of you know input. Or I guess I should say connection to people at that high level on opposite sides of the political aisle. And he just didn't care. He, you know, ultimately, and this is the other thing about Hoffa that gets lost in all the Where's Jimmy stuff, you know, he loved the union. He loved the Teamsters. The Teamsters was everything to him. And he was everything to the Teamsters. You know, during the time that he was president, they added members at the rate of 1,000 a week. They had over a million and a half members. They've never achieved membership like they achieved under his leadership, although obviously the labor force is much greater today than it was then.
Hoffa commanded such loyalty from so many. What were his strengths as a leader?
I've given that some thought, and I think it has to do with, number one, he really was passionate about his people, and his people were Teamsters. And when you're passionate about something and you really get a sense that, you know, you're for these people and they get that sense from you that here's somebody, look at this, you know, the feds are after him, you know, they threw the kitchen sink at the guy. They spent a decade unsuccessfully trying to put him in jail before they finally succeeded. And I think it has to do with being, like, as I say, he had a passion for it, and I think he was very smart. He was somebody that was not to be underestimated. And at the end of the day, he just looked in the eye, and you really get the feeling. I mean, I would have loved to, now that I know as much as I know about it, I would have loved to, I love to go back and look and see that meeting with my father and Hoffa in that Minneapolis hotel room where they both went at it, you know, eye to eye, toe to toe, for 3 hours. It would have been fascinating to me because here on the one hand you have Jimmy Hoffa who just literally, I mean, he's used to getting beaten up by police and by corporations or companies that had hired labor busters, he's as tough as they get. And then on the other side you have my dad who in order to survive Angola had to essentially cut away his ability to even experience or acknowledge fear. So here it's the ultimate, the immovable force meeting the immutable object, and so I think it's a passion and a desire coupled with just an energy. The guy had boundless energy, and people forget he was only, you know, he was 5'4". He wasn't a man of gigantic stature, but he had something, and it was magical for the Teamsters, whoever whoever had anything to do with him or ever encountered him, it was something magical about, I think, his presence for them.
Hmm. Stephen Harper is our guest this afternoon here on the Afternoon Magazine. He is the son of Jim Harper, who was a Teamster, and Stephen Harper is the author of Crossing Hoffa, A Teamster's Story. Listeners, you can join us this afternoon with questions, comments, 333-9455 and toll-free 800-222-9455. Let's take another call now. A listener in Effingham, line 4. Good afternoon.
Yes, thank you. I have a question concerning the portent of the Teamsters, which I were a light delivery man for 30 years, and the company would never let us organize. But my question is, why would not the Teamsters and their ability to bring in other service workers, you know, the truck driving is really a service work, and other service workers across a board, and I was always curious why the Teamster didn't try to organize those folk, because a Teamster, as far as I can remember, a union Teamster would not cross a picket line. And the delivery of even foodstuffs or raw materials or whatever it was by a union driver and the picket line consisting of service workers trying to get fairness as well, that would have been a combination I always thought would have been almost insurmountable.
It's a good question. I don't have any idea what the answer is. And I don't know anything about the particular situation you're describing or the particular company. I can tell you they were very aggressive organizers and have been very aggressive organizers for an awful long time. That doesn't mean that from time to time there aren't pockets of places where, for whatever reason, they make a decision. Maybe maybe something funny is going on. I mean, I wouldn't want to speculate about what the particular strategies might be for why they would or wouldn't pursue a particular employer. But I think they try to do everything they can to maximize their membership. At the end of the day, that's their mission. Because without that, they can't get it done. So I don't have a good answer for you, I'm afraid.
Well, can I illustrate another situation that I was part of? I worked at a place that was organized by APSME, and we're on strike, and the drivers who delivered the foodstuffs to the organization were Teamsters. And they unloaded their load at the airport, and then a fellow union group went in trucks owned by the organization, picked up the stuff, and delivered it. It would just seem bizarre to me when that happened.
Huh.
That Teamster, you know, would have... there we're under the gun, too. I mean, it's, you know, for the decay of the union movement per se, you know, is just astounding.
Yes.
But that incident has stuck with me all these years. You know, why would a fellow union member in another department then go and complete the delivery that the Teamster got part the way? You know, if I always thought, well, the Teamster would have said, sorry, we don't go there.
Yeah. Well, it could be. You know, the Teamsters had a reputation for being, you know, somebody told me as I was writing this book, a friend of mine said, I sort of gave him the outline of what I was writing about, and it didn't even start out as a book. It really just started out as a personal story. It became a book. I'm an accidental author is the best way to put it. But he said to me, he said, Steve, he said, you know, the Teamsters, they play for keeps. and there's something to that. Although I will say that to your point on the decay of the labor movement, you know, it's been said, and I think correctly so, that one of the things Hoffa accomplished, and I think this is why they loved him so much, he really, more than maybe any other person, moved the working class man, and because there weren't any women really in this line of work in those days, moved the working class into the middle class. And so now what you see all around you, because people are talking about it all the time, is the erosion of the middle class, which is a terribly unfortunate development for the stability of civilizations, if you're a student of history. But that's what Hoffa did, it'll be interesting to see how the labor unions in particular and the movement in general reinvents itself in order to deal with the challenges it faces. But But I don't know why one union would and another wouldn't. But I do know that one of the reasons my father, I think, took such pride in being a Teamster was that I think they did, and perhaps possibly still do, view themselves as something special within the labor movement. And that could account for it. And Hoffa, if it's true, then I would tell you that that's the legacy of Jimmy Hoffa, because he made them feel that way. You're not a downtrodden person. You're a respectable person. You're entitled to a living wage. You're entitled to, you know, certain benefits and health and welfare and pension, and you shouldn't be embarrassed about that. And you know, that's an empowering message for people to hear. And Hoffa delivered it in spades.
Yeah. Before we run out of time, I want you to talk about another ordinary but extraordinary person in this story, and that's your mother.
I knew you'd get there. She, you know, if I had this to do over again, there is a way I would emphasize more clearly than I have the importance of her role in this, which was twofold. You know, she was my dad's second marriage. She was 18 years old. She was the child of a Lutheran minister, and she had four kids before she was 25. As I say, I was the oldest, and she went through this. There are two things about her that I think are particularly important. One, none of this happens. None of what my father did would have happened were it not for the fact that she was saying, you know, Jim, whatever it is you think you need to do to make this right, I'm with you 100%. And the other thing she did, though, was that, and this was true long after this particular episode of our lives ended in 1962, she really was the glue that held all of us together. You know, my father went in and out of bouts with alcoholism throughout his life. She was just steady as she goes, you know, and between the two of them, they wound up, as I say, she's a brilliant woman, too. She graduated from high school when she was 16, never went to college, with the right kind of encouragement, which she did not get from her parents. She would have been a doctor for sure. She'd done everything she needed to do to research and the schools, and had even been accepted at a place in Texas where they took women. And her father said, "Nope, you can't be a Lutheran minister, but you can teach in the parochial schools." And she said, "Well, nuts to you, I'm going to Minneapolis." You know, so you know, she really was the glue. And so between the two of them, my father and my mother, they now have four children, and among the four of us, we have, you know, 10 degrees, 10 advanced degrees, which not the degree is necessarily a measure of anything, but for two people who never went to high school, or I'm sorry, who graduated from high school but no more, to have kids who have PhDs and law degrees and all other sorts of things, and more importantly, stable families, stable and healthy families in their own right, is a remarkable achievement, and that's probably has much more to do with my mother than my father.
Yeah.
My father gave us the guts. My mother gave us the stability.
Yeah. Well, great pair.
Yeah, it worked out. It worked out.
Early in the interview, you mentioned the letters that you've received from readers.
Yes.
And I'm wondering, have you gotten a letter from James P. Hoffa?
The current president
of
the Teamsters, yes. Who's Jimmy? No, I haven't, is the answer. I don't know if I ever will. I do know somebody very early in one of my book signings said that she was the wife of one of Jimmy P. Hoffa's lawyers, and so that she was going to read the book with great interest. But I don't know. You know, his daughter is a judge is a retired judge, I think, now in St. Louis, and I haven't heard from either of them. But you know, I can imagine that all of this has got to be, in a way, sort of just the continuing conversation. In a way, is probably very painful for them, but. If they do happen to read the book, I hope they will appreciate, because this has been the surprising part for me. It wasn't part of any motive in writing the book, but I've gotten lots of letters from rank-and-file Teamsters who've said to me, thank you for taking Jimmy Hoffa out of the punchline world of jokes and restoring some sense of the important historical legacy to the labor movement that this man really deserves. So they're very grateful, the people who have and share what was Jimmy's mission, are actually grateful for the treatment. Although you can obviously view with a different eye some of the tactics as they related to the way things played out with my father's situation. But he did, you know, ultimately he survived it.
Yeah. Well, it's interesting thinking about the next generation again. You know, here James P. Hoffa, he earned a law degree from the University of Michigan.
That's right.
And like his father, though, he has been a member of the Teamsters since his 18th birthday.
Right. Yep. Yep. And you know, it's an interesting thing, too. The other sort of level of correspondence I get from people has to do with the child working through the meaning of a parent's life and coming to terms with the good and the bad. You know, there's plenty of bad in my dad's life. He'd be the first to acknowledge and admit it, and wouldn't even feel particularly badly about having people talk about it because they can learn from it. So I suspect that both both of Jimmy Sr.'s children, I suspect there's been a similar kind of evolution of an understanding in the lives of their own parents. Although I have to tell you, I didn't really have it, and I'm in my early 50s now. I didn't have it in the way that I now have it until I went through the process of learning what I learned to write this book.
There we have to leave it. We're out of time. Steve, thank you very much for talking with us this afternoon.
Thank you. It's been my pleasure.
Stephen Harper is the author of Crossing Hoffa, A Teamster's Story. The book was published last year. It's now also available as an audiobook from Spoken Books Publishing. Our guest, Stephen Harper, has been a litigation attorney at Kirkland & Ellis LLP for more than 20 years. He's a grad of Harvard Law School and Northwestern University. He is an adjunct professor of trial advocacy at Northwestern University's School of Law. You'll find him online at www.crossinghoffa.com.